is Evo Morales building a road that will help his fellow indigenous people develop, or are there interested parties at play here?
Yeah, there are plenty of interested parties, and of course, he's got different indigenous constituents, and sometimes their interests are counterposed against each other, unfortunately, because it's a country with scarce resources, and you have a process of colonization going on from the Andean highlands into the lowland jungle areas. It's been going on since the 1950s, or actually it picked up in the 1950s and the 60s when the U.S. went in there with some big programs in colonization, foreign aid, started opening up the roads to the jungle areas of the country, which represents about two-thirds of the country. A third of the country is in the Andean highlands, the mountains, Andean mountain chain. And the rest is all is two-thirds in the lowlands, which, you know, as in the 50s became... It started opening up more with road infrastructure projects and so forth to be able to resettle populations in the mountains there and from crowded communities, and communities weren't able to support all the people who lived there. So they started migrating, and that was pushed by this colonization process, which was a public policy, again, supported by the United States and different Bolivian governments. Of course, the military at the beginning and the democratic elected governments after 1982 were fostering this policy, and part of the problem was the highlands were too crowded, and they needed to open up new land so people could grow food for the national population and to find a way to make a living. So you had this populism colonization which began. So these people are people with Quechua and Aymara backgrounds who are looking for new land, so leave the highlands and move into the jungle. Then the government follows by building roads and different kinds of development projects and so forth. So what we're seeing here is this is still being played out in the scenario we see today, because what's at stake here is Amazonian lands, which are going to be colonized further if they build this road. And this is what the whole conflict's about, because they're worried that this is going to degrade a protected area where the road is going to run through, which is has various environmental services for the country, its water supply and so forth, as well as, you know, climate change, and its ecosystem is very fragile. It's in this rainforest area. So,
yes, we should tell people that the Tipnis is the area in particular that we're talking about just now, one of many protected areas. And it's smack dab in the middle, and it's divided by any access outside, if you will, with the Andean Mountains between it
exactly.
And the coast. So it's still a very isolated area, I would say, or a natural area. We're talking about 220,000 square kilometers of Amazon in Bolivia. And Bolivia has protected a fair amount of its land, about 45%, which is, as a percent, of course, much higher than Brazil. So we have this history of colonization. Explain a little more to me the indigenous split between those who believe Evo has their best interest and those who don't. Opponents of the road say that he's a destroyer, not a defender, citing his offering money to some and willingness to destroy Pachamama, if you will. How divided are folks? And this must be difficult, since Evo himself is indigenous, of course.
Yeah, well, one of the problems is, I mean, with this colonization policy, that indigenous peoples from the highlands have been invading the lowland indigenous territories for decades and taking over these lands and deforesting, contaminating the rivers. And out of this, a whole sector of these colonists who come into the indigenous lands in the lowlands, again, pursuing their own welfare, but their own future, their families, have grown coca, which is, it's licit and illicit in Bolivia. But a lot of the coca grown in the Chapare River Morales grew up is illicit because it's used for processing into cocaine, for Brazilian, U.S. markets, and so forth. So that adds another complexity to the picture. It's not just colonization of highland indigenous into lowland indigenous lands. It's often to grow coca, which has this legal markets, and this is used for processing cocaine, which gets people into all kinds of criminal networks and so forth, which is a shame because they're just doing it to try to make a living. But the end result is that, and there are all kinds of policies and programs to try to eradicate, and that brings all kinds of conflict with the farmers. So anyway, Evo Morales comes from this Quechua Aymara Highland background that's been colonizing these areas for years. And part of the problem is if the road goes in, the belief is that more of these are going to be colonized. It's going to go right into Tipnis, and this is a very fragile environment, and it produces a lot of the capacity for the hydric system for the cities for creating reservoirs and so forth, because the way the rainforest seeds the clouds, which then go toward the Cordillera mountain chain, they collide with that, and the rainfall goes into these reservoirs, and then it goes into the cities and the water supplies that draw upon. So the whole hydraulic cycle here that's going on is caught in the middle of this process. So basically, the indigenous and the highlands and lowlands have come in a conflict in this colonization process. Now, they figured out over the years how to accommodate some of these groups and so forth. So, but then in 1990, and Bolivia had a major land reform in the 1950s. If you know your Latin American history, it was the second biggest land reform in Latin American history. It was after the Mexican Revolution, which took place in 1910. And then you had the Bolivian in the 1950s, and the indigenous in the highlands were able to take over the government, defeat the army, implement this whole land reform thing, which broke up all the haciendas in the mountain areas. Again, in the highlands, where two-thirds of the people live. However, you still had this two-thirds in the lowlands where you had smaller populations that were not affected by the land reform at all because people were not organized, they were not aware, there were no really roads into these areas, but people occupied larger areas because of their resource management strategies were not farming. They were picking fruit from the fishing, all kinds of different foraging processes and so forth, which were less intensive on the landscape. So you have these two populations. And historically, the highland peoples have invaded the lowlands. I mean, there have historic conflicts that go back to the time of the Incas. You can see the Incas created colonies in some of the lowland areas to exploit the resources of the lowland indigenous. So it's not this homogenous mass of indigenous peoples working together, but they're fragmented by these different interests and resources and so on, which they have control over. In 1990, Tipnis all of a sudden became a very visible place in Bolivia for the whole population, was that there were timber interests, there were cattle interests, and they started going into these indigenous areas that hadn't been touched before by these outside extractivist kind of interests. And so people organized themselves and did a march, and they marched 34 days all the way to the Sea of Government, which is in La Paz. And this dramatic march changed people's perceptions of lowland indigenous and people also who have rights to these resources, not just the lands, but to the forests and to the rivers and to the different aspects that the environment provides there. And so all of a sudden, in 1990, you had this historic march where, for the first time, a government recognized these indigenous territories in the lowlands. So at that time, they gave executive decrees. It took six more years, and they finally got another government to give them legal titles. And that opened up the whole thing for titling indigenous territories in this two-thirds of the Amazon region of the country, this two-thirds of Bolivia, which is Amazonian. So you have these newly titled things because the land reform in the 50s, since it's where the highland people is breaking up these haciendas, was just parsing out small holdings to people after they broke up the haciendas. But here in the lowlands, we have this whole new concept, collective ownership. It's not going to be broken up into small parcels. Part of the reason is because the resource management was different from farming resources. It was had multiple kinds of resources these indigenous peoples were using. And so the idea was to create a territory, and they could draw on these multiple different ecological zones for their subsistence and livelihood and so forth. They could be used for ecotourism and other kinds of projects. So they got their titles, but then the titling process, the different stages of it took time. And so when Evo Morales came to power in 2001, these laws have been created. In 2005, these laws have been created in 1996, as I said, but they're only haltingly implemented to give people their titles to these collective territories because there were all these interest groups putting pressure on the governments because they wanted access to these resources as well. Evo Morales comes to power he created a coalition of people from the lowlands as well as the highlands, which was very unusual. So he started appealing to the lowland people, also protecting their territories, empowering them, bringing them into the state, an apparatus that never happened before, as he'd done in the highlands. And so his party came to power in 2005. He was inaugurated, and he came to office. And a lot of the lowland indigenous peoples were also represented in the government, in local government. Some were sent as ambassadors. I mean, this is Bolivia's kind of broke this apartheid that the country had through its political system for centuries and started putting indigenous peoples into decision-making roles, into positions of power, and cabinets, and local government, regional governments, and also in government offices, and a whole range of decision-making. So this coalition was going, but then it broke apart in about 4 or 5 years into his first term, beginning the second term, because his government realized that by adopting an extractivist development policy, they could, at a time when hydrocarbon mineral prices were going up because of China's development and India's importation of these minerals, put more pressure on these resources in Bolivia because they were trying to respond to these international markets. And the idea was that they would use these minerals to export, raw materials, and the money they would get, they would invest in these communities through these cash transfer programs, which was just transferring cash. It wasn't any kind of development in the programs. And another dimension of this is the president, being indigenous, adopted a very strong discourse politically of saying he was going to save the environment for humankind, and he was in, this is a real indigenous government that had a different view of using resources and a different model for development. And so they were arguing all of these kinds of things. But then after 5 or 6 years in office, there was this shift. And one of the things that happened, of course, was conflicts in Tipnis started showing that this shift was going on, that the government wanted a more extractivist model, and they were not going to respect these local collective territories, nor the fragile and environmental systems. And they started, soybean expansion on a major scale with connections to Monsanto and all these other big companies, and paying less and less attention to the environmental effects of all this, the deforestation, the contamination of water. And then, of course, you got this other player, which are the coca growers, and that's his major constituent. He comes out of a coca-growing background. He was brought to political office first as a congressman, and then all the way to the presidency, and as a labor leader, because the coca growers were resisting coca eradication programs driven by U.S. drug war, plus the Bolivian government, which created agreements with the United States to eradicate coca. And so that took a lot of different forms and so forth. But Evo Morales was leading the coca growers against these policies, and as a result became very well known in the country. And then when this had this big collapse at the end of the 20th century, of the neoliberal governments, that he was one of the few leaders on the opposition who had been in Congress and had a strong constituency. So he used that coca grower political empowerment to take him all the way into Congress and all the way into the highest office of the land. That was his main political base. So that's a real important piece of this story, because we're talking again about the colonists. We're talking about the highland people who've gone into the jungle, into the lowland territories, and they who live there, who are farming coca and doing it in a way that diminishes the natural resources. The soil fertility is going down, they're contaminating the water, it's deforesting. So all of these processes are taking place as a result of the coke expansion. That's his main constituency. What's going on right now is, according to the critics, and they claim that they have evidence of this, but Evo Morales made a pledge to his coca-growing constituency 5 or 6 years ago, that he would open up Tipnis for the young people that needed lands there, other colonists who were coming in. So that border between the coca-growing area and Tipnis would no longer be recognized, and Tipnis's as a protected area, as indigenous territory, would not be recognized as well. And so by building this road, this would open up for these coca-growing populations who live right at the southern point of the Tipnis territory. So there's a borderline there that he actually negotiated back in 1990. This was the borderland for the protected area in the indigenous territory with the coca farming areas. And so now he would take that away, build a road through there, and his argument, the government's argument, is that we're doing this to improve the levels of living of people who live in the park. We're going to raise they don't have good schools, they don't have health services, so all of this road building will, in effect, benefit them, first and foremost. And then it'll benefit the development because it's connected to other regions of Brazil and Bolivia, and they can, resources can flow and transport costs can go down and so forth. So they're saying, we want to this road to cut through here to improve the lives, but also to help Bolivia develop and have roads that connect it to different regions and then lead to connections with Brazil and so forth for its development. Now, the people who are criticizing this road are saying, wait a minute, you made a pledge with the coca growers, and you're really going to open up this whole system through this road to benefit your coca growers that you represent, and you represent in the Congress, you've represented as a union leader, as a president, that's been your major constituency, and you want to foment more coca in Bolivia through all these people who have been loyal to you and voted for you and mobilized for you. So that's what the critics are saying. And then they go on with all the environmental arguments, saying this is not only, the coca is going to also destroy this park. This has got a real important environmental service for protecting water reserves in the country if you destroy this park. And that they're saying is as soon as you take that away, their protected area status, the people are going to invade. It's going to be an invitation for all these colonists, as they've done throughout Bolivian history, to go in, mark off land, start deforesting, build their homesteads, their farms, whatever, and settle there. And then the local indigenous become peons to them, or they're forced off their lands.
Yeah, because historically, the lowland indigenous folks have not benefited from things like the coca growing, right? So there would be nothing that would say that this new development would benefit them at all.
Well, yeah, what we've seen already, because the coca growing areas were invaded earlier and they had indigenous populations living in territories, and often what happens is the lowland indigenous become the peons, the workers for the highland indigenous, because the highland indigenous are much more aggressive, better organized, and they can throw their weight around. The lowland indigenous are not. They're more meek, and their organizations are not as strong. And so you have, they get themselves into an inferior labor position. They might be growing coca, but they might be doing it for somebody else. So it's unusual for them to have their own farm and do this and so forth. But the whole thing is, you know, Bolivia's got limits on how much coca it can grow, and so by going into Tibnis like this, it's going to go beyond the limits that they have recognized by the United Nations and all these international accords and so forth. And so it's going to violate those kinds of agreements as well. But the government's saying this isn't going to happen. The coca growers aren't going to pour into the area. The road's going to benefit the indigenous who live there. It's the people who criticize the government's plan who are saying, we know behind this is the whole interest in coca, spanning coca there. They're also saying, well, you're going to bring soybean growers, you're going to bring cattle ranchers, all these other kinds of interests that are going to make life miserable for the lowland indigenous. So they're not going to be able to keep their current status in their territories.
Right, and then we have mining interests at play here too, right? Isn't China, Germany, Switzerland, U.S., Canada, Australia, South America have all applied for mining licenses?
Well, this is the whole thing. This characterizes the approach of the government, as I mentioned before. It can be defined as extractivist. They're trying to increase hydrocarbon development as fast as they can. They're developing other mineral resources. They believe he has a lot of natural resources to develop. And they've turned over a lot of these areas to the Chinese. And, of course, the lowlands growing soybeans. Almost half the soybean growing is done by Brazilians in Bolivia. So, you know, it's really more and more extractivist economy, and they want to increase the scale of this production, increase the earnings as a way. As a government can, you know, it can hold its constituencies by redistributing this income that comes from this short-term extractivist policy. But the long-term or even medium-term environmental consequences are very severe.
And I guess soy and beef-related industries have deforested something like 29% increase last year, but only 10% of that is under indigenous protection. So lowland indigenous aren't benefiting from industries like soy and
soybeans. There's a sector among the soybean producers that includes colonists who come down from the highlands. There's a small sector there that does that. Most of them are larger scale commercial operators, like the Brazilians who come over and buy lands in Bolivia. But there is a small highland group that benefits from soy production. They get up to maybe, 100 hectares or something. They're not small anymore, but they've been able to rise up as colonists to become part of this commercial agricultural strategy. But most of them haven't been able to do that. And the lowland indigenous are not at all. They're not included in these plans at all. They don't have access to the resources or education or they're very discriminated against. So they don't have a role, and I don't think they feel comfortable in those kinds of projects anyway. So they're left out. And again, a lot of times the expansion of the areas in this extractivist model encroaches on their livelihood and their lands, which they lose out to. And now there's also other areas in Bolivia, other protected areas that the government says are up for grabs now because they want to expand production for greater income. And this is going to affect other indigenous populations in the country. They've marked other places where they're going next. So it's a development model that they have decided on after being 5 or 6 years in office. They decide this is the best model. When they decided to do this, these mineral prices were an all-time high, hydrocarbon and so forth. But now, as these international prices have declined, they still want to go forward with it, but I think it almost wants them to produce more because they're getting fewer economic benefits. They have to increase the amount of production to keep up.
And so is this Tipnis a symbol of indigenous areas?
In 1990, it was the place where the first territorial rights in the lowland Bolivia were recognized, and that was due to a 34-day march, very dramatic, which marched all the way to La Paz for 34 days. And they had the support of everybody, and they had the support of the Highland peoples. Everybody came out. The Highland peoples marched with them for part of the march from different places along the road, and they, even the coca growers, supported them. The only people really opposed the march were the private sector that had some of the interest in logging and cattle ranching in the area, but it was almost universally across the board a huge consensus supporting their emergence as political and, you know, development actors and Bolivian citizens for the first time, a recognition. When they reached La Paz, a lot of people said they'd never seen people from the lowlands before. When they reached La Paz, they said that we'd never been to the capital before. We didn't know what it looked like. So it was a very dramatic, historic event in 1990. And then subsequently, we have all this controversy raging around this area. So it's kind of, you know, it's historically important, too, because and Evo Morales at that time was a coca grower leader of the Federation of the Unions there, and he went out to negotiate the boundary from the coca growing area to this new new indigenous territory. It had been recognized as a park before, and now it had been 1990 is recognized as an indigenous territory, but that they didn't get their titles until 1996 when a government put through a new law to give lowland peoples our collective land rights titles.
Now, there was another long march in 2011 that was a pushback to an attempt to do away with the protection of that area that was called untouchable in English. So that was effective. But then August 13th, this August, President Morales, I guess, asked his Congress to pass a law that would revoke that protection.
Right.
So now are there factions within the government that are lining up pros and cons?
Well, I don't think nobody's lining up against the government within the government these days because the government doesn't tolerate any kind of different opinion. So what happened along the way is since that first march, that government, high government officials like the United Nations representative from Bolivia, they quit the government because this is hypocritical. You're saying one thing, we're doing another. We thought we were supporting indigenous government with a tremendous vision of environmental rights and protection and the ecosystems, then we find out that they really want to produce an extractivist model just like everybody else in Latin America. And so they bailed out. I mean, they had a very strong person in the United Nations, their representative, who had a very strong, made very strong speeches in favor of the environment and then realized that the government back home was not doing what he was saying they were doing, and they were doing just the opposite. So a lot of those people left the government over the last 6 or 7 years. They bailed out. They couldn't. A lot of these very talented people, very committed people. It's kind of a sad. They left. So that group has gone. And people who are in now believe in what they're doing. I think they believe that this is the best thing for Bolivia's development. It's the best thing for the lowland areas of the country. That they need to link up with better roads for the economy. Now, one of the interesting things that the opposition to the road are saying, I think this is important because they're saying is, we're not opposed to a road. We can have a road that'll do the same things. It doesn't have to go through the middle of the park the way this road is designed to do. We can go around the park on the eastern side, and actually in a way that almost touches the communities. So, and they say most of the communities are up there anyway, the indigenous communities. So if you want to do real services, health and education, you should have the road go up that way because that's where the people really live. And these other areas where you want to build this road, a lot of it is not inhabited. And so they're saying, why build it through the center of the park, which is going to have all these negative environmental consequences, when you can do it around the park and it still connects to the kinds of road system you want to connect to. So that is a really strong argument, it seems to me. And so it's not as though there's road or no road, and it comes down to that. It's just a lot of times in the polemics, it comes out as, you know, there's no real alternative, but there really actually is an alternative. People put this up, a number of very well informed people have put up and shown on maps and so forth, and how in many ways it would be a cheaper road. It has all these other advantages and so forth. So I think that's a pretty, you know, it's kind of calling their bluff. I mean, let's have a road and all the benefits you're talking about, and it'll get us closer to the indigenous communities, or ironically, this other road outside the park. So what's the problem? You know, we're all for a road. And, you know, the other thing is that the region of the Beni, which is a large region in northern Bolivia, that their government officials have also come out and said, we want the road. This is going to help our region to develop. it would seem to me it kind of undercuts their whole interest is really not so much the mineral or the coca development. It's just to have a better road that they're more integrated into the national economy, and they can get that through this alternative. So that surprises me. I don't hear the government responding to that. I mean, what is their answer to that alternative? Why is it so much better to go through the middle of the park and the indigenous territory? Why is it so much better to link the road to the northern part of the coca-growing area, which can open up the region more for the coca growers?
Is the Roman Catholic Church involved in this situation at all? Are they weighing in?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned. I mean, the Catholic Church, actually inside the territory, it does have a school or a high school for indigenous kids. And the government came out a few weeks ago and said that the church owned lands there, and the church had come out and said they were against the way the road project was being developed, and they wanted to the government to consider alternatives. And the government shot back saying, well, but the church owns a lot of land, and they're trying to protect their own interests there. But it turned out with the church, the land that it owned was for this high school, and they were giving education to these kids. And that's a private Catholic high school exists and had, you know, some lands that they occupied there. So the church has spoken out against the way it's being conceived, saying that other alternatives have to be considered. And, you know, the Pope Francis is very strong on the environmental side of things, and he's, you know, spoken out not on this particular project, but in other projects in Latin America, and generally against the extractivist model. So the church has come out and made statements, and it's been attacked by the government for making the statements. And so I think the government's kind of shout them down because they don't want the church to mix in because it adds legitimacy to the opposition's arguments. This pope we have is, you know, strong on the environmental front, so the church really has an obligation to stand up for these rights, these environmental rights.
The government and the Roman Catholic Church have been at odds. I know that the government now recently is demanding that the church officials produce the names of government officials, which the church is accusing of involved in drug trafficking and so forth. So they've gone toe-to-toe, I think, on a number of issues, I guess.
Yeah, there have been a number of tensions there, and the government has attacked them on different fronts to criticize them, saying they've lost their legitimacy because of all the scandals that have come out and so forth. But they've been a fairly consistent voice criticizing the government on various issues. But I think the church was very supportive in the beginning of having an indigenous government, and the kinds of policies it started out with was very supportive of. And, of course, then we have large orders like the Jesuit orders in Bolivia, which have been very active in the indigenous, supporting indigenous movements as intellectuals, as labor leaders, as educators, and so on. And that's been going on for a long time. And they have a large group of Jesuits in Bolivia. And so they also, one of their leading intellectual, who's a national opinion leader, Javier Albo, this Jesuit anthropologist, writes a lot of op-ed pieces in the national newspapers, and he's been writing a lot about this issue to be an opinion leader from this part of the church.
Are there other resources that you'd recommend for our listeners to stay in touch with this situation?
Well, I think there's a lot of stuff on YouTube. I don't know to what extent, you know, Spanish, of course, there's a great discussion. It's actually done very didactically, a lot of charts and maps and so forth by Roger Carvajal, showing how what had happened to Tisnes gets deforested and what will happen to the water cycles in Bolivia for the large cities. It's playing a key role right now. It's one of those important areas in the country for this water supply system. And so he does a very good job, presentation by him with charts and graphs and maps and so forth, learning a lot from him.
How will this play out, do you think? Is this a trend that's just going to keep going, that the Highlanders will stay in control and eventually gain more territory? Or do you see indigenous folks getting some unusual allies to balance the power?
You're saying in Bolivia, right?
Right.
Yeah, no, I think, well, we've seen periods where the highlands, you know, the areas have been protected. I mean, we know the state can do it. It really has a political will because Tipnis was protected for a long time. There's a boundary right across the bottom of Tipnis with a coca-growing belt that hasn't been violated and only occasionally violated until now. And that was, you know, 1990. So it's possible when your government really has a will. It's not easy for them to do it, but if they really have the political will, you can accomplish that sort of thing.
Professor Healy, thank you so much for your time and for orienting us to this situation. We will keep abreast of things and watch as things develop.
Okay, thank you. It's been a pleasure.